Former Iowa City resident John Bloomfield has been arrested for the murder of his wife, a death that occurred 16 years ago. This hour, how advances in DNA forensics are improving criminal cases. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, after a tragedy that claimed the lives of two Iowa boys, we'll talk about safety on frozen ponds, lakes, and rivers. Iowa Public Radio's Dury Buscarin on her Iowa Defense Contractor series, The Legacy of Nelson Mandela. Iowan John Little tells us about his big feat, the completion of his 13th Ironman triathlon, and the closing of an iconic restaurant in Mount Vernon. It's a News Buzz on River to River after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we have a News Buzz edition of River to River this Friday in store for you. Coming up this hour, about a half dozen topics we'll be touching on in quick conversations. You heard last week former Iowa City resident John Bloomfield arrested for the murder of his wife. It was a death that occurred 16 years ago. This hour, we'll talk about how advances in DNA forensics are improving criminal cases. Also, IPR's Dury Buscarin will be with us. She'll talk about her Iowa Defense Contractor series, The Legacy of Nelson Mandela, as the world is mourning. We'll touch on that. And Iowan John Little tells us about his big feat, maybe not what you think. He just completed his 13th Ironman triathlon. It took him 14 hours. But first, last weekend, an all-too-familiar winter tragedy. Two brothers from the southeast Iowa town of Prescott, the Fry boys, Nathan, 9, and TJ, 11 years old, playing outside when they wandered onto a pond covered with thin ice. According to the Des Moines Register, it appears the boys fell through the ice about 20 yards from shore. Divers located their bodies. They were flown by helicopter to the Des Moines Hospital, where they were pronounced dead. Joining us now by phone, information specialist Mick Clemesrud from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We want to discuss a little bit about ice safety in light of this tragedy. Mick Clemesrud, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ben.
How easy is it to misjudge ice, whether you're a young boy, young precious boys, as these were, I'm sure, or you're an adult? How do you judge whether it can support you or not?
Well, that's an excellent question, and especially the way it's going this year. We had that initial freeze and initial blast of cold weather, and it sealed up a lot of our lakes and put down quite a bit of ice. We had reports from, 5 inches of ice across northern Iowa, and even in central Iowa, there are some of our, medium or smaller sized bodies of water had frozen. And when you go out initially on that ice, there's a couple of things you want to look for. You want to look for, of course, if there's any separation from shore. You're going to want to take a spud bar with you, which is a really heavy metal rod, and you bang that, chipping away at the ice in front of you. If it doesn't go through the ice, you can kind of go out a little bit further. You're inching your way out. You're going to want to take your ice auger with you and cut a series of test holes, and you're looking for thickness of at least 4 inches for what we call general activity, like ice fishing or ice skating, or if anybody's skiing on the ice. And then you don't want to go out alone. You want to have ice fishing as a social activity. You want to have friends with you in case the worst would happen. There would be somebody there could help you get you out. And when we talk about ice, we always say there is no such thing as safe ice. There is always risk associated with going out on any frozen body of water because it always changes. Ice is not the same thickness on any given body of water. There is a lot of variations, and there's things that do impact that. It can be wildlife, such as geese keeping an air pocket open. We could have an aeration system on the lake. There could be, if there's trees poking through the ice, those are can conduct heat when it warms up. Those will warm up. If the sun hits them, those will warm up, and it can melt the ice around that area and just create less stable ice conditions in that area. Even rocks sticking through the ice, those are also places that can conduct heat. Docks are the same thing. So there's a lot of factors that can really go into, what when people have to go out on the lake for them to consider to be safe.
Mm-hmm. you mentioned, you know, what if we all think, what if something does happen when we're on the ice? If you're in a group, someone falls through. If you're not that person who falls through, what should you do?
Well, we always recommend that anytime you're going out on the ice, you have a couple of pieces of safety equipment. They're really simple things, and they're very inexpensive if you don't just have them lying around. One is about 50 feet of rope. That'd make it long enough so you can stay away from the problem area. And the other would be like a common boat cushion that's required for a motorboat. They call it a throwable flotation device. And when not in use in rescue, it's a great thing to sit on because it's very comfortable. But you can detach your rope to that. It's got handles on it. You can throw it to the person who's in trouble, and they can hold on to that, and you can pull them out of there. If you're out by yourself, which we don't recommend, you can get some ice picks, and you can make those yourself, either tying some rope with two screwdrivers, or you can make your own handle, or your own ice picks out of an old broom handle and some nails. So there's a few safety things we recommend people when they go out. Plus, you're going to want to, everybody's got a cell phone now, so if something would happen, you'd have to be calling for help, because in the weather that we're experiencing right now, while I'm optimistic and enthusiastic about it because I like to ice fish, I know this is going to be building ice for us. If you would get wet and get out on this, you wouldn't last very long.
Mm-hmm. What does not very long mean in this case?
Well, I'm not sure what the hypothermia, there's a lot of factors.
Minutes?
I'm not sure. You'd have to ask a health professional on that, but I just know that you'd want to get into shelter and get out of your wet clothes quickly. Mm-hmm.
The worst nightmare for the parents of these boys from Prescott and family and friends, a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old. What words do you have for parents about the way they should talk to their kids about this?
It's heartbreaking because I have two kids and they're right around that same age. And I wonder yourself, how would I feel about this? And it's just devastating, if I had a pond, and this is just me speaking, if I had a pond, I would make sure that those kids, we talk about safety on the farm. If you're out in the farm, you're going to have a lot of things. You talk about safety. This would be another one saying, this is not safe. You don't go out there until mom or dad says it's okay to go out there. And then, at the time that this had happened, we had initially some ice, but, and that's in far southwest Iowa, and then it's an area in the state that's kind of what we call the banana belt, where it's going to be warmer, warm winds, and it's the warmest part in the state. So that's going to be a little bit later for ice formation. But, know the conditions of it. Make sure you're aware if you have that in your area, and talk to your kids about, just like anything else, if you're going to look both ways to cross the street, you're going to want to say, this is another potential danger, and so this is what we're going to do until mom and dad says it's okay.
Extremely cold temperatures now have moved into the Midwest now. Does that necessarily mean we're safe until spring?
No such thing as safe, remember. What's been going on is that the wind, even though it's been so cold, wind does inhibit ice growth because of all that moving water. It really has to get cold. Now, as soon as the wind lays down, it's going to freeze up, and this is the best case scenario if someone likes to ice fish, because we don't have any snow right now, and this cold weather is really going to put some ice on. We're going to add a lot of thickness to it, and it's going to happen in a hurry. But once we get a good layer of ice, and then snow comes. Snow can be good or bad for ice growth. It can either prevent ice growth if it happens too early. That's the worst case scenario, would be you get about 2 inches of ice and then you get 6 or 7 inches of snow on top, because that will really, it'll insulate the ice from the cold weather. Mm-hmm. And later in the year, once you get that ice depth, you don't mind having snow on top because it will act to protect the ice from the warm weather. So it's snow can be good or bad, and that's something we always talk about, especially later in the year, is if you're going out on a body of water, a frozen lake, and you see snow that's off color, doesn't look like the rest of the snow around it, that would be another warning sign that you want to stay away from that area, because something is going on there. Either there's water coming through the ice, or there's a weak spot or something that's causing that to be discolored. So you stay away from discolored snow and discolored ice.
Mick Clemesrud, thank you very much, of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources. A little bit about ice safety in light of this tragedy. Thank you very much, Mick.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition on this Friday. Last week, John Blumfield was arrested at his home in St. Paul, Minnesota for the 1997 murder of his wife, Frances Blumfield. Blumfield reported his wife missing on September 22nd in 97. Her body was later found near Rockford, Illinois, in a ditch, bound with pantyhose, wrapped in plastic and duct tape. Originally, there wasn't enough evidence to make an arrest, this despite the fact that John Blumfield gave inconsistent accounts of the time leading up to the murder, also in the discovery that his wife was missing. In the meantime, with advances in technology, recent DNA testing revealed that hair found on the duct tape was used to wrap Frances Blumfield's body. It belonged to her husband, that hair. This morning's news told us that Blumfield has waived his right to fight extradition to Iowa for murder charges. Joining us now, Andrea Roth, assistant professor at the University of California's Berkeley School of Law. Andrea Roth, not so much here to discuss this case, but in general, how DNA has changed the criminal justice system. Professor Roth, Andrea, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you with us. Now, tell us, broadly speaking, how has the use of DNA testing by investigators, prosecutors, changed the way cases involving murder or rape are tried?
Well, it's certainly given them an added powerful tool. Every day you hear media reports about cold cases being solved by DNA, but a lot depends on the case. And just to begin with, I don't think many people necessarily realize that a DNA match doesn't mean that it's definitely the DNA of the person who whose DNA is consistent with the DNA found at a crime scene from 20 years ago. It just means that the defendant's DNA and the crime scene DNA are consistent at the 13 or so locations along the DNA strand where police and prosecutors look. And so in a case like Mr. Blumfield's, if much time has passed, the DNA might be degraded, and so police might only be able to develop, say, a partial profile at only 5 or 6 of those locations, which means that more people are going to match. So if you had a witness who said the killer had glasses and a mustache, the fact that Mr. Blumfield has glasses and a mustache would be incriminating but might not be enough on its own to convict him. So DNA is a powerful tool in these older cold hit cases, but it very, very much depends on the case, how degraded the DNA is, and the Blumfield case isn't your typical cold hit case either. Usually you have an unsolved crime and police get a hit to an offender with a prior conviction in a state DNA database like Iowa has. But here they already had Mr. Blumfield's DNA because he was already a person of interest even back in 1997. So this is not your typical cold hit that you hear about on the on CNN. But
we don't know his defense, but he is pleading not guilty. So from your perspective, the way to refute this DNA evidence is what?
Well,
the degradation that you were talking about.
Yeah, there are a few possibilities here. One is coincidence. If the DNA is degraded enough that, let's say, 1 in every 1,000 people will match the profile, then in, let's say, you have 70,000 people living in Iowa City, 70 people might match that profile. So if you have very little other evidence against a person, you could definitely have a situation where the match is coincidental. Here, we have a person who has a pre-existing relationship with the victim. So my guess is that this isn't going to be one of those cases where coincidence is going to be super compelling, but there might be innocent explanations for the DNA depending on the circumstances, especially when you have someone who is living with the victim. You could have DNA transfer through laundry or touching. People even talk now about the possibility of framing, that you could plant someone's DNA at a crime scene. You have contamination possibilities, misinterpretation of results. Not knowing more about the case, it'll be interesting to see what else we find out about the scene and why his DNA may or may not have been on the items of evidence that they collected.
Andrea Roth, assistant professor of the at the University of California's Berkeley School of Law. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to a Friday News Buzz edition of our program. About a half dozen news items that we didn't get to earlier this week. Short conversations about things that are relevant to us here in Iowa on our News Buzz edition. As the United States scales back its military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Department of Defense is ramping down some of its demand from domestic manufacturers, also here in Iowa. Companies like JTEC Associates, and we know Rockwell Collins, both of them based in Cedar Rapids, are seeing their government sales drop. Greg Cares of Cobham PLC, which builds oxygen systems for military hospitals and has a facility in Dubuque, explains.
We all understand that defense spending likely is going to come down and maybe needs to come down, but this is what members of Congress are saying. This is what even, I think, the Pentagon leadership is saying, which is, can we please have some guidance that we can make some decisions that reflect our needs and take money where it can be taken and put money where it needs to be put.
Dury Buscarin joins us, the author of this three-part series, the last part of it airing today. Dury, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Start off by telling us a little bit about the context in which this takes place, this drawdown, the lessening of contracts to military contractors. It's part of a nationwide trend.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, this is the natural thing that happens at the end of a period of war. We're scaling down in Iraq and Afghanistan. And with that, the military is also, they need fewer supplies, they need fewer arms. And in addition to that, their budget is being cut by sequestration every year. It's about $50 billion across the board.
There's been a first round, and we may have a second round of sequestration.
We're expecting a second round in January. And so what we wanted to look at with this series is how domestic arms manufacturers are kind of adapting to seeing lower sales on the government sides of their business.
So tell us a little bit about the companies that you focused on. The smaller of the two, JTEC Associates, that's a name we don't hear much about. What do they make for the military?
Right. So JTEC Associates, it's 12 employees, and they're headquartered in Cedar Rapids. And they make a crosswind sensor. It's an aluminum tube about 2 feet high, and it goes in an M1 tank. And those tanks are used all over the Middle East. It's this one widget for this one tank that actually directs, it takes in the wind and figures out basically how the wind will affect a shell that's being shot out of the gun of a tank. The other side of their business is flow meters for automotive.
And this wind sensor, you can actually see a picture of it on our website and also listen to any of the three-part series that Dury put out this week. Are they having, JTEC Associates and Cedar Rapids, having any success keeping their workforce busy with non-U.S. government contracts?
Not necessarily. So the larger businesses tend to be able to go into the global markets, like Rockwell Collins, for example. JTEC has actually been shifting their focus to the automotive side of their business. You see this with a lot of defense contractors because a lot of military technology crosses over into the commercial sector. So JTEC, for example, they have 75% of their business in 2007 was this one widget for this one tank. This year, 75% of their business is commercial. They're selling flow meters to companies like Caterpillar. They're concerned, but for now, they say it's all right, and they're not really sure how much longer it's going to make sense to contract for the military.
Right. You brought that out in your piece. Is a drawdown is understood, but these companies would really appreciate a bit more predictability.
That's the difficulty with budget cuts in a sequester format. With the sequester, it's pretty much across the board. So you cut the same percentage from your tank program, from planes and your ships. The difficulty that the military is having is there are certain programs that they'd rather not see cut and certain programs that they think probably they don't need.
Right.
And on the other side, these contractors don't really know from year to year how much business they're going to have.
Mm-hmm. So Rockwell Collins, on the other hand, as you brought out in your feature, $1 billion worth of military business for Rockwell Collins in 1 year. They have other avenues to fill in the gaps to make up for lost U.S. government business, right?
That's true. Rockwell has a huge presence in business aviation. They basically build the brains of planes. So they can go pretty much anywhere in the commercial sector. As far as their government sales, from the U.S. military, those sales are going down. But what they've seen and what they've been able to do is make up for a lot of those losses by selling to the militaries of other countries. So we profiled a deal they have with the Brazilian Air Force installing flight decks in the KC-390. They also have been contracting with the Saudi Arabian military. And I mean, Rockwell has had a couple tough years. In 2011, they had some layoffs, but this year their stock has been steadily rising, and it seems like they're making that transition into a post-war world.
Mm-hmm. Dury, for many years, going back decades, we've heard examples of how the military's use of contractors can be expensive. Sometimes you hear about parts that are seemingly ridiculously expensive. Did you get any insights on why sometimes it seems so costly and is so costly?
There are a few reasons for why. The military actually can't sustain operations without heavy support from contractors. This began in the 90s, and really in 2011, Donald Rumsfeld's idea of tooth to tail, which is essentially the ratio of military support, people who are doing things like cooking and cleaning and building and maintenance at
that
time.
Up to the teeth.
And the teeth are the combat soldiers. And mm-hmm. So the idea is that in a period of war, you transition some of those people who are support into a combat role, and contractors, private contractors, come in to fill the gap and become support personnel. Mm-hmm. That is an expensive way to do business, especially over a prolonged period of time. A study by the Project on Government Oversight, which is a nonprofit think tank, they found that on average, what the military will pay a contractor is 1.83 times that it costs to pay a military or a federal employee. And that includes federal benefits. But part of that is overhead, for example. A lot of these contractors are working in government facilities. They need background checks. They need desks. They need computers. And that adds up.
Dury, your last part of this three-part series focused on the Iowa National Guard. We're running out of time, but tell us, what's the picture like there?
So the Iowa National Guard is really interesting in that here in Iowa, they've actually been moving away from that model of using a lot of contracted personnel. It's kind of an uphill battle, but it's a trend that I heard we're going to see more of across the military. For example, more units are having a service member that is trained as a food service specialist, essentially an Army cook, and instead of having catered meals every time they do a training. So it's a way to do cost savings, and it's a way that they hope will continue.
Iowa Public Radio's Dury Bouscarin, thank you very much for this three-part series this week on Iowa Public Radio that looks at defense contractors here in Iowa and the effects of sequestration. And if you missed any of those features that Dury produced, you can always find them at iowapublicradio.org. Dury, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, the legacy of Nelson Mandela. We'll reflect a little on that. Also, Iowan John Little tells us about his big feat, the completion of his 13th Ironman triathlon. Also, the closing of an iconic restaurant in Mount Vernon, the Lincoln Cafe. That's all to come on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a Friday News Buzz edition of our program. Still three topics to come, first of which people around the world are mourning the loss of South Africa's first black president, an historic figure who led South Africa out of the era of apartheid. Nelson Mandela dying yesterday at the age of 95, surrounded by his family at his home in a suburb outside of Johannesburg. Mandela was imprisoned from 1964 to 1990 for his work in bringing racial equality to South Africa. Here's an excerpt from a speech he made in Cape Town, February 11, 1990, after just being released from prison.
Our march to freedom irreversible. We must not allow fear to stand in our way. Universal suffrage on a common voter's roll in a united, democratic, and non-racial South Africa is the only way to peace and racial harmony.
Nelson Mandela, after being released from prison in a speech from 1990. Now joining us, Deborah Daylaw of Drake University, a professor of politics and international relations. She specializes in human rights, peace building, and justice. Joining us now to reflect on this remarkable life, this remarkable leader, Professor Daylaw. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Deborah, tell us, Mandela led South Africa out of apartheid into a multiracial era of democracy. What was it about him specifically that allowed him to be such a successful leader?
Well, I think you have to focus on his deep-seated commitment and impulse to democracy. To me, it's remarkable. The first thing I thought of yesterday when I heard of his death, I'd had the opportunity to visit Robben Island in 2009, and an image came to my mind of this incredibly grim, tiny cell that he'd lived in for years as a political prisoner, and thinking of all of the injustice and indignities that he suffered during that time, let alone the indignities, discrimination, and injustices that he suffered under apartheid, even before being a political prisoner. And the remarks he made at his trial in 1963 mirror, in large part, the same thing he said in the speech you excerpted at the beginning of this segment. And as I was thinking about his experience as a political prisoner, to me, the natural impulse would be for a person to be bitter and to act on an impulse towards retribution. And instead, he persevered in his commitment to democracy and human rights, even after everything that he'd suffered. And it's just remarkable to me, the fact that he and so many other black leaders in South Africa embraced this democratic impulse is why they were able to make the transition from an oppressive, corrupt system of minority rule to my multiracial democracy. And that's quite a legacy.
Mm-hmm. In fact, yeah, after being imprisoned for 20 years, 27 years, he advocated forgiveness. He had tea with his former jailers after becoming president. And that was really a key to making the modern South African democracy, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Although, I guess one dimension to this that I'd like to add, I think appropriately, commentators are celebrating the impulse for forgiveness and reconciliation as opposed to retribution. But one of the things that I think may get downplayed too much from my point of view is his the intelligence and political pragmatism of his approach as well. That, you know, other leaders coming out of corrupt, post-colonial, anti-democratic systems pursued retribution. And not only because of an impulse towards forgiveness, but also because it was the politically wise thing to do in pursuit of economic and political stability, he chose a path of forgiveness, which prevented people who had the institutional experiences in running the bureaucracy, who had wealth to kind of help move the country forward in terms of economic development, rather than fleeing. They stayed, and many of them becoming more committed over time to building the multiracial democracy. And so I want to credit not only his impulse for forgiveness, but sort of incredibly smart and pragmatic approach to how you build good governance and how to make a democratic transition. I think that's really, really important.
Mm-hmm. Undoubtedly, the remarks you just made were things that President Obama was thankful for in his remarks yesterday when he said, "I am one of the countless millions who drew inspiration from Nelson Mandela's life. Like so many around the globe, I cannot imagine my own life without the example that Mandela set." So for politicians, for us all, something to learn.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that has disappointed me in some of the coverage that I've heard is in celebrating his legacy, it's been discussed as, you know, he's been discussed as an anti-apartheid activist, as the father of South Africa, as an icon for the African continent. And I just think that's far too limiting. He was so much more than an activist. He was a transformational leader. I would say he should be considered one of the greatest statespersons in all of history. And that his model is of great value, not just for South Africans or Africans, but for everyone. And it's really, really important that that be remembered.
Deborah Daylaw of Drake University, thank you for joining us with these reflections on the passing of Nelson Mandela yesterday.
Thank you for having me.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, while most of us were enjoying Thanksgiving leftovers, or maybe cleaning up the house after visiting friends and family had left last weekend, my next guest was in Mexico, taking a little swim, followed by a little bike ride, and finishing up with a little jog. Actually, the only thing little about these three activities was the name of the Iowan who was doing them. Last weekend, 61-year-old Iowa City resident John Little completed his 13th Ironman triathlon in Cozumel, an island off the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And now, you may be asking yourself, what is an Ironman triathlon? It consists of a 2.4-mile swim, followed by a 112-mile bike ride, finishing up with a marathon, a full marathon, 26.2 miles, all these raced in that order and without a break. John Little joins me in the studio.
Thank you, Ben.
Welcome. And are you still hurting from what happened?
I am. It's a long race.
You have done 12 other of them, so it was not unexpected. This is your 13th Ironman you've completed. Your first was in 2007 at the age of 55. You finished this one in just over 14 hours?
14 hours and 3 minutes.
What stood out for you about this one?
You know, every race has something, has its own challenge. This one had a beautiful swim in ocean water that you could see for 50 feet. But the bike ride, we had a 20-mile-an-hour headwind on about a third of the bike ride. And then it opened up and rained during the marathon, probably 2 inches of rain during the marathon. So we were slogging through water.
Literally going through inches of standing water.
Literally through inches of standing water during the race, yes.
I understand at the start of the race, the swim starts it out, and in the days before, there was stormy weather out on off the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula.
Yeah, El Norte arrived. They had a winter storm, which for them meant it dropped the temperature down to the mid-70s, and there was strong wind and some rain. So all week long, that was taking place, and they had to cancel the practice swims because the current was so strong, and they actually had to change the swim course the night before the race. So there were some last-minute changes to it because of the current was so strong.
Mm-hmm. What do you see out there when you're swimming? Is it idyllic as we see in postcards?
You know, in this race, it was. As you're swimming with people bumping into you on either side of you.
And we have to remember there are over 2,000 competitors.
2,400 people start out treading water together. All 2,400 in the water, the cannon goes off, and you swim. And so it's bump and grind, swim. But you can see the water there is so beautiful. I was swimming and watching flounder on the bottom and watching various fish and things. I mean, you literally could see the flounder 20 feet below on the bottom of the ocean. It was beautiful.
Uh-huh. What part of this race gave you the biggest problems? What was the biggest challenge for you this time around?
Well, for me, the biggest challenge is always the marathon. Just as my knees wear out, being in my 60s and with my knees wearing out, that's always a challenge. All three parts are really a challenge. The swim is not the longest part by any means, but it is in some ways the scariest part.
Is that generally considered among triathletes to be so in Ironman triathletes?
It is. I mean, it's the shortest part of the race by far, but the combination of water and sometimes it's cold water and sometimes you're wearing a wetsuit and all those people bumping into you, it's a challenge.
I understand also in this one, with the help of your wife, you found a man who was a competitor who was in some real trouble.
Actually, my wife spotted him. The marathon ran right past our condominium, and my wife was sitting in the rain in front of the condominium. And as I came by, I was going to exchange a water bottle with her, and she pointed to the back of some young guy and said, "He's in trouble." And so, I wouldn't have noticed it. I ran up to him and looked at him and asked if he was okay, and his lips were blue and quivering, and he looked at me with big, wide-open eyes and just shook his head no. I don't think he could even speak at the moment. And I, well, what am I going to do with him? I turned around, and there was an ambulance maybe 70 meters ahead. So I ran up and got them.
You find out what happened to him?
I did. He ended up being taken to the hospital and treated for shock, and then was released later that evening.
Mm. Such an extreme test of endurance, can it be life-threatening?
It can. You know, of course, it's a minuscule number of people who actually die, but it does happen.
Who actually die, you said.
I remember, I think it was 2 years ago now, there were 17 people in the United States died doing triathlons, and 15 of them died during the swim. Mm-hmm. I've been in two that people died in.
Last year, one of them?
New York City. I was in the Ironman New York City, and a 42-year-old endurance athlete, a highly accomplished endurance athlete, died. And it was the most recent one.
Mm-hmm. So the big question for many listeners is going to be, why?
What a good question. It's a challenge. It's a physical and mental challenge. It keeps you motivated. If you sign up for an Ironman, you darn well better train.
There's your motivation right there.
Exactly. When that alarm goes off at 3:45 in the morning on a winter morning, you've got a reason to get up and go train. You've got to do it because you've signed up for the race.
Have you ever had to stop or given up during the middle of an Ironman triathlon?
No, I've never. It's called a DNF, did not finish, and I've never received that and don't intend to.
How?
If you ever see DNF after my name, you'll know something broke.
A bone.
Something will have gone wrong if you see that after my name.
Okay. Well, how many times in a triathlon, an Ironman, do you feel like giving up in the course of the 14 hours? Do you ever?
I never feel like giving up. If you feel like giving up, you're going to give up.
Don't you have to fight some inner voice that says, I can't take this?
No, actually, the only voice I have is says keep going, go. I mean, you have to have that motivation. If you're contemplating giving up, you're probably going to give up.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long endurance race. It's a cliche to say that, you know, how much mental it is. It's mental, as much mental as physical. But in a long endurance race like this, it's some truth to that.
Okay, how much of this is your body, and how much of this is your head to get you through it?
Yeah, it's hard to say percentage-wise, but it is a big both. Both are important. You cannot do long endurance race of 12 to 15 hours or more without training for it. But you do also have to have the mental determination to do it.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you have more Ironman triathlons in your future. What's coming up?
I'm registered for Ironman Canada this summer in July. And I've got my sights on the World Championship in October, which I'm now qualified for under what they call a legacy program for people who have done enough. Most people get into the World Championship by winning their way in, but they also allow some people who have completed enough triathlons to be qualified to come in under a legacy program.
And this triathlon in Hawaii is the big daddy. This is the World Championship. This is where it started.
It is. It's where it started, and that's the one that's on. A lot of people have seen it on NBC every fall and winter when NBC does a big show about that race.
Mm-hmm. Where did the idea for an Ironman triathlon come from?
There were some Navy SEALs in Hawaii 30 years ago or so now, a little over that, and they got to debating who was the best athlete. The swimmer or the biker or the runner. And so they decided to combine three different events that took place there, a 2.4-mile open water swim, and an around-the-island race of 112 miles, and then the Hawaii Marathon. They said, let's do all three in one day. And anyone who can do that, we'll call them an Ironman.
Mm.
And that's how it started.
And it caught on. Looking at you, you said it has a military history. Looking at you, you look like you may have a military history, or don't you?
Yes, I was. I served in the Army about 40 years ago now was when I started. Yes, I was a paratrooper in the Army.
Mm-hmm. What's your greatest satisfaction out of competing in an Ironman?
The satisfaction is just that, the satisfaction of having faced such a momentous challenge and coming through it and finishing it. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Everyone who's done it, when you cross the finish line, the announcer calls out, "You, John Little, you are an Ironman." And everyone loves that line, to hear that line.
Mm-hmm. You're 61 now. You have 13 Ironman triathlons behind you. How long do you want to do this?
You know, I've been telling people that my goal is to keep doing it till I win my age group in an Ironman triathlon, even if it doesn't happen till I'm the only person in the age group.
How did you place in the 61 age?
I was in ninth place in this particular race, and gee, if I hadn't had a flat tire and a bike penalty, I think I would have been in sixth place.
All right. John Little, we wish you many Ironman triathlons in your future. John Little of Iowa City just finished an Ironman triathlon in Mexico, finishing the swim, the bike ride, and the complete marathon run in just over 14 hours. John Little, thank you for coming into our studio.
Thank you, Ben.
And finally today, Chef Matt Steigerwald's menu has garnered both praise and attention far and wide. Well, in a few days, though, no longer will it be there to charm patrons' taste buds. After a dozen years, the Lincoln Cafe in Mount Vernon is closing. Yes, you heard right. It happens just in a few days on the 21st of this month. Executive chef and owner of the Lincoln Cafe, Matt Steigerwald, joins us now to discuss this decision and the future. Chef Steigerwald, Matt, hi.
Hi, how are you, Ben?
I am doing fine. The big question for those who are just hearing this for the first time, why on earth, after such a huge success, would you want to close the Lincoln Cafe?
Well, you know, we have the Lincoln Wine Bar down the street as well, and we do wood-fired pizza there that we're really proud of. And when we opened, when I opened the cafe, you know, one of the goals was to kind of help elevate the Eastern Iowa sense of cuisine. And I think we did a pretty good job helping with that. And it's good for me to move on to other things while I still have energy for them. I'm almost 50. I'm not almost 50, but I'm in my late 40s. And it's hard to see other opportunities when you have your head down in the business every day. And I just couldn't see myself doing it for another 20 years in that same space. I want to do a little more work down here at the wine bar. I really like the pizza. You know, the dough stuff is fun for me. The wine is fun for me. But I think it's just about feeling like wanting to get out of something while it's still a living thing, an alive thing, a vital thing, and not wait too long to look at other opportunities and see what else there might be.
Okay. I heard one of the problems you're trying to figure out as you close is the Fries for Life people.
Right.
You offered free French fries for life to any customer who had
right.
your restaurant's slogan, "Food is important," tattooed on their body?
Correct.
And how many of those people are wandering around?
I think it's close to 30 people.
30 people?
Yeah.
So what's the remedy if you've come up with one yet?
Well, we will be getting them, you know, like some sort of a deal down here at the wine bar. You know, whether it's, you know, like, I don't know, like a free, you know, like pizza once in a while or something. We're going to work something out with them. But, you know, I mean, also a little personal responsibility. You know, did you think that I'd be around as long as you'd be alive? You know, but yeah, you know, we'll make them happy somehow.
Okay, but
sure.
you haven't had any lawyers call yet.
Not yet. Not yet. And, you know, when I happen to, you know, like see one on the screen, I just don't answer.
What will you? You said it's time to move on. Move on to what?
Well, you know, I mean, that's the thing. You know, like I say, it's hard to see what other opportunities are out there without letting go of what's behind. At least for me, I've never been good at sort of seeing what's next without letting go of what I've been doing.
I see.
You know? So I don't know what's out there, but I do think that letting go of the day-to-day operations of the Lincoln Cafe will help me to have energy to look around and see what else I'd want to do.
Well, we'll look forward to finding out what that is as it develops. What will you miss most about operating the Lincoln Cafe?
Well, you know, we've really developed a great staff over the years. A lot of them have been around for years and years, and those relationships are going to be hard to not have around every day. I do enjoy that a lot. I still love to cook. I mean, we'll find, you know, we will look for a way to do something with food beside the pizza. I just don't know what that's going to be.
Okay. We'll leave it there, and we'll wait for the next chapter in your life. Matt Steigerwald, as this one closes in a few days, the Lincoln Cafe in Mount Vernon closing. We want to reiterate, though, that the Lincoln Wine Bar, you said, is open just down the street in
Correct.
Mount Vernon. You'll be there doing some work as well, right?
Correct, correct. Wood-fired pizza we're very proud of down here.
Matt Steigerwald, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up on Monday on this program, between 2008 and 2012, Iowa experienced a record amount of flooding, variability in rainfall, you remember that, led to damage that cost the state billions. Next time, on Monday, we'll look at how climate change is impacting extreme weather patterns, the economic impact as well, how we in Iowa can best prepare for the years to come, extreme weather conditions. Monday on this program, River to River, produced by Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.